Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Years ago, I tried to do a show on a subject that I found most interesting. It was hard getting these two guests that I had in mind to get together to come into the studio, and it never happened. In the back of my mind, I thought, one of these days, I'm going to come in contact with someone who is an expert in the field that I want to talk about. So this is literally a decade later. I recently returned from New York City where, among other things, I attended a conference that was put on by the Council on Foreign Relations. If you listen to National Public Radio, you have heard many people from the Council on Foreign Relations give their take on various foreign policy issues. It's a very prestigious group, and I'm absolutely honored that I was asked to attend this conference. And this conference specifically was on religion and diplomacy, religion and foreign policy. It was a wonderful couple of days. And in the midst of all of this, of course, naturally, aside from the workshops and the speeches and the panels that you're seeing, one of the great things about events like this is the networking that you do in between. And shortly after my arrival there on this Friday evening, I met Imam Ronald Shahid, and we became fast friends, actually. We just clicked, and I thought, this is a man that can fulfill that role that I had an idea of 10 years ago. And that is the Black Muslim movement in the United States. This, of course, also encouraged me. That is the recent death of Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali is a perfect example of someone who was born into a Christian household and later took up Islam. First, the Nation of Islam, and then he joined the more orthodox strain of Islam. And to say he was a game changer is modest at best. And Muhammad Ali was not known for modesty. Regardless, let me tell you a little bit about Imam Ronald Shahid. He's been the director of education at the Clara Muhammad School and the resident imam at the Sultan Muhammad Islamic Center, both in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's been doing this since 1998. He was a representative of Imam W. Dean Muhammad and his ministry for interfaith dialogue from 1998 to 2008, during which he was a member of delegations to the Vatican, Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Imam Shahid was also a Muslim chaplain in federal and state institutions in Florida, and was the resident imam at the Islamic Center of Tallahassee, both in the 1980s. He's been a newspaper columnist and a TV and radio host covering Islam. Imam Shahid completed the Hajj, that is the pilgrimage to Mecca, in July of 1989 and February 2003, and completed Umrah, that is to say a minor pilgrimage, in December 1995. He has a Bachelor's of Arts in Sociology from Berea College in Kentucky, and a Master's of Education, Guidance, and Counseling from Florida A&M University. We welcome to Common Threads Imam Ronald Shahid. Hello, Ronald.
Hello, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing very fine, thank you. Thank you for joining us. And I got to tell you, when I said we became fast friends, here's what clinched it. So, as you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were at the Council of Foreign Relations, on foreign relations. We were at the reception, the opening reception, and we found ourselves in a little trio. It was you, myself, and an Episcopalian minister from West Virginia. We were in conversation, and you brought up the fact that you had a relative. Was it an uncle who was in the Negro League?
Yes.
Okay.
A first cousin.
I'm sorry, a first cousin. So you had a first cousin who was in the Negro Leagues, who was really quite a performer. And didn't you say that he did not make it to the majors?
He was called up. He was one of three African-Americans who were called up and the other two, one of them was Jackie Robinson.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Yes.
That's right.
And he, of course, he was not in the prime of his career. He was a much older player, and so was the other guy. But then, of course, you know the history of Jackie Robinson.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So we were having this conversation about the Negro Leagues, and then just as we were about to start the conference, I turned to you, and with the straightest face I could muster, I said, Ronald, I don't want you to embarrass yourself. If you tell that story again, we don't use the word Negro anymore. Okay. And you, the look on your face, I said, it's Black or African American. And I wanted you to hold that face for, you know, just about 2 seconds. And then I go, I'm kidding. And the nice part about it is you didn't hit me. You didn't ignore me for the rest of the conference, because I knew just in that 5 minute conversation, this is a guy who would get it, who would realize, okay, I'm dealing with an idiot, but he's a nice enough guy. Fine. So now that we have that out of the way, the reason we're having this conversation is the African American Muslim experience has always been fascinating to me. I grew up in Detroit, and every once in a while I would see busloads of African Americans all dressed in white, with head coverings. And I couldn't really define it. I was too young, and of course it, I also would see very well dressed young Black men, meaning they were dressed in suits, usually with a bow tie, and they would be standing on street corners, and they would be handing out papers, newspapers. But they would never offer one to me. I never took offense to it, but I just thought it was interesting. So it was later on in my childhood or early adulthood that I started learning about the Black Muslim movement, the Nation of Islam, and the part that it has played in the development of religion here in this country. And so our meeting was fortuitous because, as I said in the introduction, I've been wanting to do this show. So if you don't mind, let's deal with a little bit of history of Islam in America, specifically in the Black community. Now, my first question is this. Do you know what was the percentage, or can you give me any idea of the number of people who were brought over against their will in the past 400 years, who were practicing Muslims? Was that a large number, or were most of them still practicing the traditional animist religions of the African nations?
Yes. Well, the scholars are verifying what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, who was the first leader of the Nation of Islam. He said that the majority were Muslim. And just in recent years, say the last quarter century, scholars have been on some level supporting that idea that the great many, if not most, but a great many of them were Muslim. Of course, they were taken from West Africa, and Islam had a long history there, though it was declining. You know, the Songhai Empire, Mali, Ghana, those areas, Islam had gotten a firm hold in those areas. And so this is where the Africans were taken from and brought over to and made slaves. So not quoting what the percentages were, it was I feel, from my readings and everything, that it was a large percentage.
And were they forced to convert to Christianity, or was it more of an organic embrace, if you will?
No, I think that the process was that they were not allowed to express any religious belief. And over time, with the splitting up of families and everything over a few generations, and, you know, slavery existed in America nearly 300 years. So much of what would have been handed down, perhaps from parent to child, was lost, you know. I always felt that it would be an interesting research project. If, and I don't know, maybe someone already did it, in terms of following the as much as they can the evolution from the first generation of Africans in this country, their culture, their language, their religion, their history, and then, you know, when did it, what caused it to disappear? If it didn't disappear, what form did it take? Dr. Cedric Lincoln, who was a sociologist of religion at Duke University, his theory was that there was a genetic memory in African Americans concerning the religion that they had in Africa. That was his explanation for why so many African Americans were, you know, converting to Islam. That was his theory, that there was a genetic memory.
I've always
Go ahead. He told me that that he was working on a book that would go from the early time of Islam in Arabia with the Abyssinian slave Bilal, who became the first caller to prayer under Muhammad the Prophet, and would come all the way to America and the experience in America. But of course, Dr. Lincoln passed away before he finished the book.
I see. It's always fascinating to me whenever I, say, watch a movie about slavery or read books about slavery, that the slaves really took, it seems, that they took to Christianity and embraced it fully. And, of course,
right.
then used it as a tool to free themselves or at
yes.
least to aspire to freedom.
Yes. Dr. Lerone Bennett, in his book Before the Mayflower, I guess that was the name of it. Maybe I have the title wrong. But he confirmed in his research, because Dr. Bennett, he was at one time was editor of Ebony Magazine.
Okay.
But anyway, he wrote a book, Before the Mayflower, and he said in his book that there were none, it was just a few of the Africans were Christian who were brought here. He said, but when they realized that it was Christian people that were, you know, where they were going, you know, they were coming to America and those people were Christian, he said a lot of them said that they converted to Christianity. They were Christian. And that was to make sure that their treatment was better, and perhaps maybe even they would send them back to Africa. So he said much of it was pretense, especially in those first, you know, perhaps 100 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that in the years approaching the end of slavery, or maybe even after the end of slavery, they were allowed to practice Christianity, but they would always have someone who was a Christian there to make sure that their ceremonies were the way it should be. And so I don't know if there was a smooth transition to Christianity, but of course it was the only religion at that point that the slaves knew. So I think it probably just natural that they would convert to Christianity.
Right, right. If you're just
The history of the AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, is that, what was the man's name? I can't remember his name, who started the African Methodist Episcopal Church because they were not allowed to worship at the white church. So they started the AME Church.
Right, right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and my guest today is Imam Ronald Shahid of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Yeah, and what I find fascinating is that you had slaves embracing the religion of their captors, of the slaveholders. And within the religion, I believe, as they understood it, the Bible gave permission for that. So here they were in a religion that was interpreted to give permission for slavery. Kind of like it's going to keep us here. Like we're going to be slaves, and we probably deserve to be slaves. And I'm just, I'm speculating here now. Regardless, after about what part of the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century was there a movement toward Islam? You can answer either towards the Nation of Islam or Orthodox Islam.
Yes. Well, the history is rich with anecdotes, I would say, about Muslims coming to the New World. It's understood that Christopher Columbus, his navigator on his main ship, was a Moor. Some of the scholars say that the reason why they were in that capacity was because Muslims, especially from North Africa, had come to the New World. And they had maps, and that Christopher Columbus was, and his people were following those maps to try to find a route to India, I think. But anyway, Dr. Lincoln, in a dialogue several years ago, said that he had found an edict or a command from the rulers of Spain to the conquistadors in the field, the Spanish conquistadors, and it said to them that they should limit the number of Moors or Muslims who were coming with them on the expedition because they were teaching Islam to the Native Americans. Mm. So, Islam is it's there in the history. It's perhaps not so well known. But anyway, in the early 1900s, specifically the 1930s, Marcus Garvey, Noble Drew Ali, and Elijah Muhammad, all being African Americans, were introduced to some form of Islam. Elijah Muhammad went on to form the Nation of Islam. Noble Drew Ali formed the Moorish Science Temple. And then, of course, Marcus Garvey, I understand that after he was put out of America, or they took away his papers or something. Anyway, my understanding is that he converted to Islam after that in England. But the most prominent of those three was Elijah Muhammad, who went on to be made kind of famous by the what was his name with CBS?
Mike Wallace?
Just passed away recently.
Mike Wallace or Morley
Mike Wallace,
Safer.
Right. Yeah, okay. Mike Wallace did a expose, I would call it, in the 1950s called The Hate That Hate Produced, and it was on the Nation of Islam and its teaching of separation and that sort of thing. So now the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad becomes the most prominent group. And, of course, the rest is history when you talk about Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali and others.
Now, in the Nation of Islam, as I remember, so, for instance, the young men on the street corners wearing suits and bow ties, they were members of Nation of Islam, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, we talk about the Nation of Islam, and I'm sure for good reason, that they were separatists. They used rather fiery rhetoric, such as white devils and all of that. But they did provide a sense of discipline and unity in the black community, correct?
Yes.
So talk, talk about some of the aspects that weren't all that destructive in the Nation of Islam.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, the core effort of the Nation of Islam began in Detroit in 1933, and then moved to Chicago, and then eventually to Milwaukee. And it being in the depressed areas of the African American community in the during the Depression, the teaching was trying to get the men, especially the men, to, you know, make jobs for themselves. I mean, you couldn't find jobs, so the best way to do it is to make jobs for yourself. So Elijah Muhammad's teaching was that we have to do for ourselves. And it went on to say you have to carry yourself in a dignified manner. So every young man was encouraged to get a suit. If you only had one suit, clean that suit up every day and every night, and then put it on every day and look, you know, like you were somebody, so to speak. So that was those young men you would see on the corner with the bow ties. And more than likely, one of the jobs they had was selling the paper. The first name of it was The Final Call, and then eventually it became Muhammad Speaks newspaper.
Yeah, that's what I remember, Muhammad Speaks.
Yes. Yes, Elijah Muhammad, he first wrote articles in what is called the Pittsburgh Courier. Now, that's a lot of African-American people, if they hear that, it'll bring back memories if they are 50 or 60 years old, because the Pittsburgh Courier was one of the most widespread African-American newspapers in the country. Well, Elijah Muhammad wrote an article in there, and eventually, you know, he started his own newspaper. So, they were taught, these young men, they were taught to take care of family, get married, take care of your family. So all these, what was seen as things that make for proper civilization, they were taught that. And they were encouraged to execute those teachings, you know.
That's interesting that you wouldn't find all of that, the discipline, the family values, etc. They weren't getting that from the African American Christian community?
Yes. Yes, they were. They were. But by this time, in the 1930s, there had been a big, exodus of African Americans out of the South coming to the North to find jobs. Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, Columbus, Ohio, you know, and New York City and those areas. And they were moving away from those traditional circumstances that they had, you know, in the Christian faith. And they came to these big cities, and, you know, the rest is history, in a sense that, you know, the cities produce a lot of, I would say, social maladies that you wouldn't have found in the South at that time among African Americans.
Right.
So this is what was being addressed, that, you know, in these cities where people are all pushed up together and expressing certain social behavior, this is what Honorable Elijah Muhammad was addressing, you know, encouraging them to, in a sense, come back to those values they had learned in Christianity. I mean, I didn't know it when I joined, but now I look back at it, and so many of the things that they were teaching were things that I already knew because I grew up in the South, and my grandparents raised me. My grandfather was a Baptist minister. So you'll find our group that evolved from the Nation of Islam and then in 1975 followed Imam W.D. Muhammad, his son, we would be probably closer to those values and ideas that you know, people who have Christian heritage practice today. And we don't see a great difference between practicing Islam and practicing Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism Judaism, we wouldn't see the big difference we see is just rituals. And so it's almost like a completing of the circle, so to speak.
Understand. Imam, we are about down to the wire for this particular program, but I've certainly enjoyed our conversation, and we have much more to talk about, so I'm hoping you'll join us next week.
I'd be happy to.
If people are interested in what you have to say, what's your website?
My website is thoughtsforsearches.com. One word. Thoughtsforsearches.com.
Wonderful. Okay, Imam Ronald Shaheed, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Common Threads, and we will continue this conversation here on WGVU-FM next week. I'm Fred Stella.